Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, I'm joined now by the writer John Connolly. Welcome, John.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you made it by the skin of your teeth. John, you've a new book, The Land of Lost Things, which you'll get to in a minute. You've also picked five songs for us that mean something to you in your life. And I know you're a huge music fan. You make playlists to go with your books. You have a radio show on RT Gold. So music is a big part of how you engage with yourself and the world and that, is it?
I think it is for a long time. One of the things I became very interested in over the years, particularly for the RTE Gold show, was nostalgia.
Yeah.
And sometimes we tend to be dismissive of nostalgia. We think people who are nostalgic are living in the past. And there's a department in the University of Southampton that studies nostalgia. I want a job there. I mean, days of watching Dad's Army reruns would be great.
Yeah.
And what they found is that you should take maybe half an hour out of your day, two or three times a week, to be nostalgic, to listen to something from your adolescence or your young adulthood that you liked, to watch a TV show that you liked, because they've discovered that it has health benefits. When they showed it to old people, if they showed old people films that they'd liked or played music to them, they found their body temperature went up. You know, when we talk about the warm glow of nostalgia, it's actually a physical effect. And those things that we love from the past become very important when we're in times of trouble, because they're like pittons in the rock face of our experience. We can go back and we can fall back on these things. And they give us a sense of continuity and connectedness. And I think we all instinctively understand that. We know people who are unhappy in the present because they've never come to terms with their past.
Yeah.
So when I was doing the radio show particularly, apart from the fact that this was the music of my adolescence, this period in the late 70s and 80s, I wanted to play music for people that they were familiar with, but also music from that period that they were maybe less familiar with, to see if you can almost recharge those batteries. Can you give people nostalgia for something that's new?
Okay.
You know, for example, I think a week or so ago, Neil Young released an album that had been sitting on the shelves since the 70s. So you're getting a piece of music from that period that maybe people haven't heard before in that context. Where I know in jazz, there was a John Coltrane album discovered. So you can, I think, find new ways of listening to old music. So that
I'm
was
glad
part
to
of
hear
it for
it
me.
Because we do tend to think that nostalgia is a bit of a cop-out or lazy. Like what I rack up on my TV box at home, old Top of the Pops, you know, which they show endlessly on BBC channels.
Yeah.
And I do love a half an hour flicking through them, and you do get transported.
Yeah, and music is particularly profound in that way. What they found, especially in the study of people who have dementia, older people, is that we store music in a different part of the brain from like where you left your keys or what you had for dinner yesterday, which you can never remember. It's stored in a safe part of the brain. So it doesn't deteriorate in the same way. And it's why if you go into one of the things they've been doing with older people who are suffering from this dementia is playing the music from the period when they were hale and hearty and fully in possession. And when they do that, you find they light up. Because you're connecting back to that person who's buried in there. So it really has these very profound benefits, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just before we get on with that music, the book, The Land of Lost Things, right, is in a sense, there's an element of it's kind of a fantasy book, I think with a sense of folk horror, a bit of Alice in Wonderland, a touch of Monty Python. Okay, I'm going to tell you now, since I was a kid, maybe reading Lord of the Rings, stuff like that, I have not read a book like this, right? And I was like, oh, fantasy. But then I found that this book had more meaning in it than a load of novels I've read recently, because you were going down maybe back into the subconscious and into those the important stuff of life, really, wasn't it?
I think so. I think we can be very dismissive of genre. And genre is just a tool in the writer's box. It's however you choose to use it. And this was a very personal book. It follows a book I wrote called The Book of Lost Things many years ago, which was a book really about childhood. And now I've reached a different stage in my life. I'm at a stage, and I think it's probably familiar to a lot of middle-aged people, where you're on a constant low-level hum of worry. My mum, who's probably listening to the show at the moment, she's 90 and living independently, an extraordinary woman still in full possession of her senses. But I worry about her, you know, and you have those moments when she's not answering the phone. The first thing you do is leap to the worst case scenarios. My sons are living away from home. One is in Paris and one is in South Africa. So I worry about them. And I'm at that stage of life where that's what I do. I get up in the morning and I worry a bit. And the next stage of life is I hope to have people worry about me.
Yeah.
And there are times, and those of us who've been parents will know it, that you've had those where it becomes, you're given something very concrete to worry about, where you've had the awful experience maybe of being outside the operating theatre when your kid has had an accident or something, which I've certainly had that experience.
Yeah, and look, I mean, this weekend we've all seen the worst thing that can possibly happen
parent, to those extra poor parents. And in the book series, she's a single mother. She has a child who was unresponsive after an accident. And she gets to the point where something in her fractures. She simply can't take it anymore. She has that awful dark night of wondering, you know, am I putting my child through misery? Am I putting myself through misery? And she retreats into a world that is real, but that responds to all of her pain, that responds to her past, to the things she loves, the things that frighten her. And she begins to think again about this relationship she has with her child. And it's composed as well of the books she read, the stories she knew from childhood. And that's true of us as human beings. We bring all of these things with us into the world. You are the sum of these things that you read, the things that frighten you, the things that you love. And so it is. It uses fantasy, but it tries to use it in a slightly odd way to explore these realities of being middle-aged.
Yeah, so I would tend to dismiss genre as being slightly superficial. So actually, genre fiction, and in this case, a kind of a slightly supernatural kind of folky horror thing, can actually deal with the real stuff of life.
I think that's usually what it's doing, and it's doing it in a very subtle way. And, you know, this book uses folklore and fairy tales. They have a very particular potency.
They stay with us,
you know, because they speak to something very primitive within us and very essential. And so they're almost like triggers. As soon as you encounter them, they touch on something that's quite profound and deep within you. You know, all fiction is genre fiction.
Yeah.
You know, every fiction, something has a love story in it. Somebody once said there's no great American novel that doesn't have a crime in it. It's how you use that matters, rather than, you know, the fact that something has a dragon in it or, you know, a crime or three women setting up a coffee shop doesn't make it, you know, potentially less profound. It's how you use that material.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I was amazed at how I got pulled into that world. Suspended disbelief, there were all kinds of supernatural things going on, but that actually you kept getting jolted with the real profound stuff of life. The first choice of song, I suppose, has a bit of that kind of supernatural quality to it almost. And I suppose nostalgia comes into play here as well. Kate Bush, Wuthering Heights.
First single I ever bought with my own money. I found it at home. It cost me £1.99 in Dolphin Discs in Thomas Street. And I think I was probably getting pocket money of 50 pence a week. So as a proportion of income, I spent more on it than I did my first car. You know, it was an extraordinary commitment. Apart from the fact that it was my introduction, I think, to music, and also possibly my introduction to female sexuality, and that I looked at her and thought, the lady makes my tummy feel funny.
Yeah.
I think she's a kind of model for essentially how to live a creative life. And I realize some of that has unconsciously influenced me. Somebody who has very much followed their own muse from a very early age, has put up with the commercial missteps because they were creatively the right thing to do. And also in an era when says the guy who's on national radio talking about his book, in an era when, you know, everybody is accessible, she doesn't give interviews very often. And when she does, she doesn't say anything interesting, and that's quite deliberate. All you have is the music, and you have the freedom to impose yourself upon that music.
And isn't it great? Like, these people used to have a bit of mystery about them, and then I think it was better. Anyway, Kate Bush, Wuthering Heights. Kate Bush, Wuthering Heights, and that, talk about bringing your body back to times, isn't that? It's primal, really, isn't it, for anyone of a certain age? You were talking about stories and the importance of them, and then music does become part of our story as well. And your second choice is Tinseltown in the Rain by Blue Nile, but I think it's inextricably linked for you with a kind of a difficult part of your life, isn't it?
Yeah, this album came out in the 1980s, but I didn't encounter it until 1991. I bought it when I was in the United States the first time I went over there. And it's an album that's a little bit in love with the idea of America, I think. And also it's written, the first line of it is, I walk across the rooftops on graduation night. It's it's a young man's album, I suppose, about becoming an adult and moving into that world. And it was also the music I was listening to when my father was of that generation of men who, and I have friends actually who are still like that, refused to go to a doctor. Mm. You know, you unless you'd actually severed a limb, he wasn't going to go to a doctor. And so I think even though he was quite ill, he was hiding the fact of it from himself as much as anybody else. And so when I was in the US, and this music soundtracked me when I was in Maine, discovering Maine for the first time. I can remember calling home, and my father had collapsed and had been taken into hospital, and his body was riddled with cancer. I mean, riddled. I don't know how much pain he had been in, and yet he was still so reluctant to admit that there might be something wrong. And he went into hospital. I think he was in hospital when I came home, and a month later, he never left the hospital bed. And some people might find it odd that music that I was listening to at that time could still be with me, that I would still want to listen to it. But I found it incredibly consoling. I found its company really eased me. And as I've grown older, the album has stayed with me, because even though that music has stayed the same, I've changed as a human being and I listen to it differently. In the same way I could pick up a book that I'd read in my 20s now and I would read it in an entirely different way. These are not fixed objects. They change with us and they change as our life experiences grow. And I still have a huge fondness for the album. I listen to it and I never fail to discover something new in it each time.
Yeah, but it wrapped itself around you, this music, at that important time. Okay, the Blue Nile, Tinseltown in the Rain. I never gave the Blue Nile a chance, really, but people are evangelical who are into them about them. But I can see what you see in them there. That's wonderful. Now, you've a really interesting third choice, and this is kind of what you were saying earlier. This is something people might know, but it does bring us back to a very particular time, probably, and a particular time in a lot of people's lives. So this is a duet. And it's between Jeff Buckley and Elizabeth Fraser of the Cocteau Twins. Why did you pick this?
There is a concept in Arabic music called tarab, and it is ecstasy in performing music. It is the moment when you get transported by the music.
Yeah.
And we very rarely get to hear that on a record because, you know, it's composed of multiple takes. So the drummer was in one room and the singer was in another and he was doing it 3 days later. Occasionally we'll get it in live performance, but often the audience elevates it because you're part of this group experience. And Elizabeth Fraser and Jeff Buckley had been lovers shortly before he died. And having explored each other's bodies, presumably began exploring the potentiality of their voices mingling. And this piece of music was never officially released. Gradually, it's emerged and has been licensed. But Elizabeth Fraser, who has outlived Jeff Buckley, doesn't talk about it. And I think you can hear the sheer joy of these two people who are completely in love, performing together in a room with nobody listening apart from probably the recording engineer. And at the end of it, you hear something that you very rarely hear in popular music, which is Elizabeth Fraser laughing. She's quite a serious person. Yeah. And she was quite so overcome by the beauty of what she's done that she laughs and she says, oh, that was just gorgeous. And it's almost like eavesdropping on two people. You feel it's such an intimate moment. And there is a moment about 4 minutes and 30 seconds into it when their voices begin meshing perfectly. And that's tarab. You can hear it in their voices, the sheer joy of discovering this potentiality they have. And it represents everything that I love about music, the potential.
Okay, I hope we get that sense of the bit of it we're playing now. This is Jeff Buckley and Elizabeth Fraser, and this is called All Flowers in Time Bend Towards the Sun. What a great title.
It's okay to be angry, but not to hurt. Yes, darling, 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 darling.
So I hadn't listened to that deliberately because I wanted to hear it here with you. That is extraordinary, isn't it?
It's a most beautiful piece.
I can't say why, but that is extraordinary.
Yeah, she is, and she has always said she's such a perfectionist that I think she didn't want it to be released. And yet, at the same time, if she cleaned it up, all the magic would be drained from it. You know?
Yeah. As you say, it's the eavesdropping, intimate quality there of like a kind of a private dance isn't it? Yeah,
which we very rarely get to do for obvious reasons.
Your fourth choice is by the Jayhawks, and I think this is connected to your wife Jenny. Mm. Is music important in your relationship?
We courted in that old phrase. I met her when she lived in South Africa, and we would exchange emails with song lyrics, but I would also send her music because there was perhaps less opportunity to pick up music that was new or coming out there. And I'm sure half the time she put her head in her hands and thought, what rubbish is she sending me now? The way blokes do, you know, love me, love my music.
Yeah.
But we kind of bonded a bit over this song by the Jayhawks, What Led Me to This Town, because it was thematically and lyrically kind of tied in with what we were doing. And when we got married, she told a lovely story. She said that when she was thinking of moving over to Ireland with her, she had two young children, that she was looking for a sign. And she was in a car park in South Africa, and there was a Dublin registered car there. And she said, couldn't figure out where this had come from. And so she told this lovely story. And I remember thinking, it cost me a fortune to ship that car over. You know? But this song is one of those. And then we went to see the Jayhawks. We thought, oh, we'll have a moment together. And they were terrible. They were terrible.
Really?
They kept complaining about how tired they were. And I'm going, I've paid 30 quid. I don't care how tired you are. Just get on with it. But the song, I think, is just beautiful.
So this is the Jayhawks. What led me to this town?
Woke up one day in my dream.
Jayhawks, What Led Me to This Town. You can't beat a bit of good old kind of Don't Beat Americana, can you? Sparkle Horse, by the way, that guy, his brother is kind of fixing up what was going to be his final album before he died, and there's about four or five tracks out from it on Spotify at the moment. It's in that vein, but people should check it out. It's lovely stuff. Listen, will you reassure the texters here that there is going to be another Charlie Parker book soon?
It was delivered to my publishers last month, so it will be out in the first half of next year. Absolutely, it's done.
Okay. Are they easier than going back to the land of lost things?
Not easier. I think after it's nearly 25 years now, to always trying to be doing something different and not disappoint readers. The worst thing you can do is steal a reader's time. Money we can have, and if you're struggling for money, you can go to a library or you can pick up a secondhand book. But wasting a reader's time is sinful, I think. So what happens when I go and do something like the Land of Lost Things is that I kind of, my batteries recharge a little bit.
Okay.
And when I come back to the Parker books, I'm completely refreshed and I know exactly what I want to do. So I've kind of got this balance between the two, I think, after all these years.
Your final choice is Witcher the Lineman by Glen Campbell, which, again, that's almost like a song that was nostalgic when it was first released, kind of, in a way.
That's a lovely way of putting it. I think Jimmy Webb, who composed it, was very good at tapping into that sense of the past. It's an odd song because it was never finished. Very famously, Jimmy Webb gave a demo to Glen Campbell and said, I need to go off and finish this. And he came back about 2 weeks later and said, I think I've nearly finished that, figured that out. And Glen Campbell said, we've recorded it. It's it's done. I think Glen Campbell may be the most underrated musician of the 20th century.
Yeah.
We forget, you know, he played guitar on Strangers in the Night, Daydream Believer.
Was he part of the Wrecking Crew, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, listened to any record with them on it.
And he's so distinctive.
Everything. Yeah.
And I went to see him at the very end of his life. He played Portland when I was there. And he, by that time, he was deep into Alzheimer's. He was, you know, he was not going to be on the road for very much longer. And he would tell the same joke two or three times because he just, well, he obviously couldn't remember that he'd done it. And then he began playing Wichita Lineman. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. When you play somebody with Alzheimer's a piece of music, he lit up, and it wasn't, I've seen older music like Brian Wilson, who's completely disengaged when he's playing live. It just doesn't do it for him. And it wasn't just that Glen Campbell knew this music so intimately. It was that it was so tied up to his conception of himself that when he began playing it, you were looking at a young Glen Campbell on the stage again. And it was probably one of the most moving experiences that I've ever had at a concert. But it also kind of gave me hope that somewhere inside you, no matter how difficult times get and maybe how much illness takes its hold on you at the end, something of your younger self will be in there. Something of that is at your core.
The name of the film, I think, made around that time with him, which is an extraordinary film, was I'm Still Here, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, with his wife. And I just think Wichita Lyman is just a fantastic piece of music. But for that reason, I think.
John Connolly, it's so nice to talk to someone who cares so much about music and thinks so much about
it.
That music
is
such an important part of the texture of your life, clearly. And The Land of Lost Things is published by Hodder & Stoughton on September 7th. And
it's actually out in Ireland, I think, next week.
It's out next week. Okay, yeah. And listen, it's fantastic. It really
is. Thank you so much.
Well,
very kind of you.
Okay, John Connolly, thank you. And here's Wichita Lineman, Glen Campbell.
I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Okay, that was Glen Campbell, of course, Wichita lineman, and that was John Connolly's final music choice.